My name is Rosa Jauregui. I'm doing a PhD in plant breeding with Dr. Steve Haig, and Dr. Rator is my co-advisor. And I'm going to be talking about the development of cotton with ultra-low gossypol seed. So first, a background about cotton in the U.S. More than 18 million bales are produced in the U.S. in 2010, and this number was lower in 2011, but it was still high, 15 million bales. And as some of the other students mentioned, most of the cotton produced is upland cotton, or Gossypium hirsutum, and it is grown in 17 states in South United States, covering more than 10 million acres. This is a very important business. It has an estimated revenue of $120 billion per year. So what is gossypol? Gossypol is a polyphenol which is present in glands all throughout the plant, from the roots to the seed, and it's toxic to monogastric animals and humans. So only ruminants can feed on it right now. And it's a natural defense against insect pests and diseases. So why do we think that having low gossypol cottonseed is important? The annual cottonseed production averages 6 million tons, and more than 150 million gallons of cottonseed oil are produced each year. And this is fairly good quality seed. It has about 21% oil and about 23% high-quality protein that today is being underutilized because only cattle can feed on this seed. There were several attempts to produce cotton lines with low gossypol in the seed through traditional breeding methods, but this failed mainly because the plants were glandless, meaning that they didn't have any gossypol in the plant, so they were more susceptible to pests and to diseases. But in 2006, Dr. Rator at Texas A&M University developed transgenic lines with ultra-low gossypol in the seed, but normal gossypol levels in the rest of the plant. And he did this using RNAi-mediated silencing. In this picture, you can see a normal seed with glands containing gossypol, and these are transgenic seed with very, very few glands containing gossypol. So what we did is we introgressed this trait into elite lines from this transgenic line, which was Coker 312, which is an average yielding and with moderate fiber quality trait. So we introduced it into 4 lines from the United States and 6 lines from Africa. We had an F1 population, which was hemizygous, meaning that it contained one copy of the transgene. And these F1s were backcross to the recurrent parents. So we obtained a backcross 1 F1. And we did the same, we repeated the same thing and got a backcross 2 F1. At this moment, we needed a methodology to screen for the seed that had the transgene in it. So we had available a test, which is called the fluoroglucinol assay, in addition to PCR. And we wanted to see if we could find another screening methodology, because the fluoroglucinol assay is very good, it's fast, it's fairly cheap, but you need to do it on cotyledons because it's destructive. So we used the Fourier transform near-infrared spectroscopy, or FTNIR for short, and we developed a calibration curve to see if we could use it for screening, because it's faster, it's cheaper, and also it's non-destructive. So we would be able to select before planting. To develop the calibration curve, I used 100 seed samples. The spectra was collected both for whole seed and for ground seed. The instrument that was used was the Thermoscientific Antares II FT-NIR analyzer. The fluoroglucinol assay was used as a wet chemistry test, and the calibration curve was developed. We found very good correlation between the spectra and for the ground seed and the fluoroglucinol results. And the same thing for whole seed, very good correlation. However, when I tried to use this correlation curve with single seeds to predict the level of gossypol in those seeds, this was not very accurate. So this methodology wasn't used to select the Buckros 1F1 and the Buckros 2F1 seed that were going to be advanced for the next generation. So in spring of 2011, the Buckros 2F1 seed were tested with fluoroglucinol assay and selected, and the presence of the transgene was confirmed by PCR, and these seeds that were selected were planted in the field. So at this moment, in the field, I had another two set of objectives, which were to test the performance of the recurrent parents. These were tested in 2010 and 2011. The six genotypes were tested in an RCVD with four reps, and the gene turnout and lint weight was analyzed. And for the Buckros 2F1 lines, they were tested for the first time in the field in 2011, along with their six recurrent parents. So that's why we have 12 genotypes. Again, in an RCVD with four reps, and we analyzed seed weight, lint weight, and crop maturity. So for gene turnout, this is the test for the recurrent parents, which was done in 2011 and 2010. Gene turnout shows that there are significant differences among parents. We have three parents that have high gene turnout. TAM73 is one of the lines that has been recently developed by A&M, and these two lines here are the two African lines. And because there were no significant interactions between ear and genotype, these were analyzed altogether. And then for lint weight, these two, we did have significant interaction between ear and genotype, so this was split in both ears. And again, we can see some of the lines with high gene turnout having also high lint weight, and those lines from Africa having low lint weight, which is not surprising because these lines are not adapted to this area. And then when we tested all 12 genotypes together, we could see that for seed weight, there were no differences among genotypes, which is something good because we don't want actually the Buckros 2F1 to be that different from their recurrent parents. And the same thing for lint weight, there were no significant differences among the genotypes. For crop maturity, we did find some differences. We found differences among genotypes and also between the recurrent parent and their Buckros 2F1 progeny. So, for instance, in this case, there are no differences between the Buckros and the recurrent parent, but for this other line, as an example, yes, there are. And this is something that we are going to be looking at in the next year to see what happens and if we get similar results or not. So now, as conclusions for the first part of the study, we know that the fluoroglucinol assay is a reliable method for screening for the presence of the transgene in our seed. And it has the problem that we need to plant the seed and test in the cotyledons, but it is a good test. The FTE NIR calibration curve is very good, and we think that we can use it maybe for the bulk seed, not for single seed analysis. But we are also going to be testing for oil content and protein to see if we can use it as a method of screening for that. And as conclusions for the field study, we did find differences for gene turnout and for lint weight among genotypes, which is good. And we expected those. And there were also differences among years, which is also expected because 2010 and 2011 were very different years. And for the transgenic lines and their recurrent parents, some seed weight and lint weight didn't show any differences, but crop maturity did show differences, significant differences among the genotypes, so we are going to be testing this again next year. And with this, I want to emphasize the fact, the importance of this research for us, because we are now thinking about 9.2 billion people in 2050, no more arable land, and even some of the arable land being used for fuel, not only for food and feed. So we think that this is a very important way of using a fiber crop and also using it for food. So this is the message that we want to give to you, and hopefully we can get this out to help other people. With this, I want to acknowledge Dr. Steve Haig, my advisor, and Dr. Curti Rator, my co-advisor, and of course my fellow graduate students in the Cotton Improvement Lab, Jessica Kepp, the undergraduate student who is helping me every day, and of course the funding without which this wouldn't be possible, Monsanto Graduate Assistantship, Cotton Incorporated, and the Texas Food and Fiber Commission. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Rosa, did you see any differential insect damage on foliage?
No, we didn't. 2011 was particular because there wasn't a very high insect pressure, I think due to the drought and the hot weather that we had. But Dr. Rator has been testing these transgenic lines over and over in the field, and he has not found any differential damage caused by insects or pests. Yes. Yeah, the transgene has a seed-specific promoter, and it only expresses in the seed. So all the other plant tissues have been tested by Dr. Rator: roots, stems, leaves, and everything is normal. Yes, ma'am. It is difficult. Fortunately, Dr. Rator handles all the paperwork. But yes, we are isolated. Our field is very, very small in comparison to the rest. All the graduate students laugh when we need to go some work there. And we need to be very careful when we transport the seedlings to be planted. Now that I'm harvesting, I need to get rid of every single ball, open, green, everything. And USDA is there, they are controlling and making sure that we keep this in good order. You mean for the stability of the transgene? And for volunteer cotton, maybe. I don't know about that, but I'm sure I think we always use the same spot in the field. It's the first time that I do it, but if there is some monitoring afterwards, I'm sure it's being done. Yes? I think that is very regional or very country specific. So, yes, there have been problems in the past about African countries not accepting GMOs. I cannot answer that question because I think it will be accepted if we get it out. There, at this point, there are more patent issues, and the cost of releasing a variety with this transgene. But I think it will be accepted eventually. Thank you. What I did to test the prediction is I scanned some seed, then I tested it with the fluoroglucinol, and then I went back and asked the program to predict the level of Gossypol in the seed that I had tested. And in some of them, it was fairly accurate, and in some of them, it wasn't. It was about 50%. so I couldn't trust it. But the calibration curve was developed with using a bulk of seed, not single seed. So I'm, yeah. Yeah, not at this point. I could either increase the calibration curve or do a calibration curve for single seed, which is the step that I'm going now. But I don't know what will happen. Yes, that's a very good point. I haven't, mainly because HPLC is more expensive. I think that would be more accurate because fluoroglucinol is very good, but it's not that accurate. The values itself are not that accurate. They tell me it's low or it's high, but yes, HPLC would be a much better way. Yes, definitely. I know he runs some of his HPLC with USDA in campus, but yeah, I think he does that for his part, so maybe we could try for this other part.
Thank you, Rosa.
Thank you.